you quickly realize as you go down sort of trying to build out a business in this space, the airplane is like the most interesting thing to look at, but it's in some cases like the least important part of the full system. And that's a place where we made some sort of hard strategic and architectural decisions very early on in the program to steer towards an outcome where the airplane was just a cog in the broader machine.
Hello and welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors.
And I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch. Ed, you really leaned into the mic there. And it's probably because you're super excited about the conversation we actually just had with Wing CEO Adam Woodworth. And Wing is the autonomous drone delivery company that is actually under Google or Alphabet.
Yeah, no, you're right. We did just record this. I'm very excited about it. I think it's a really great conversation. My only regret is that Alex Roy was not able to be here. Always fun to get his take on sort of aviation related stuff in particular, since it's just such a pet topic of his. But we somehow managed to make do without him.
We did, and you know, we're gonna shut up here in a minute so you can listen to the interview. But I thought it was really interesting about how Legos became part of the conversation. And also there's a little bit of an announcement in there in terms of where Wing is expanding. Let's listen in and see if y'all can spot the expansion news. And then Adam, what is your official title and everything?
So I'm Adam Woodworth and I'm the CEO of Wing.
Yeah, so Wing. I'm super curious about this company because it's a spin out of Google. But I remember in the early days, it just seemed like another Google project that may or may not ever go anywhere. And I was wondering if you could kind of spin us a tale of the early days and sort of how you got involved. Were you there at the ground floor when it was still part of like more of a pilot and experimental, or did you join like once it was officially spun out and declared, you know, with the name Wing?
Yeah, I joined back in mid 2014, and I came to be an airplane designer. So like that's sort of my education in previous trade was like, you know, designing and building different airplanes. And so I came to Wing back then to just be an engineer to sort of design the next airplanes. Wing had been around as a project within, at the time, Google X, so before sort of Google became Alphabet. You know, it was really focused on like sort of, it was like a pure research experiment, like sort of what are, you know, I think people oftentimes forget that until 2016, there wasn't really like a legal way to do commercial drone operations in the United States. Like until Part 107 came out, you either had to get a COA and a private pilot's license to go fly your drone commercially, or you had to do it in restricted airspace. So this was like sort of at the very nascent stage of like commercial UAS operations. So I joined just before Wing, which was just Project Wing at the time, did their sort of first operations in Australia. I don't know if you remember back then, it was the plane looked like a little flying wing with four motors on it, and it sort of took off vertically and then tilted over and flew around. And the very original use case that they were exploring was delivering AEDs, so like dropping off defibrillators. And that was sort of like one of the first use cases that they explored. And then as they sort of did diligence on that and sort of started de-risking the technology and looking at use cases, it turns out that like getting the defibrillator there isn't the most important part if like the people aren't trained how to use it. So that use case sort of quickly fell by the wayside. And after a bunch of conversations and research, sort of targeting prepared food and sort of other like common household items were where it shifted to. So
go ahead. Sorry to interrupt, but I'm just curious, like, did you just see this as a job listing and you're like, that's weird. Okay.
So, Yeah. So it was one of my former professors was the head of the project at the time, Nick Roy from MIT. And he reached out and he was like, hey, do you want to come to Google and work on this airplane thing? And I was like, Google doesn't do airplane stuff. So
yeah, exactly.
It was interesting. I came out here, did the interviews. It was a very interesting time for the sort of UAS drone industry as a whole, because you were starting to see the glimmers of like, okay, commercial use cases are going to be a thing, but they're not a thing yet. There's like starting to be funding in the space for it, but nothing is like sort of really materialized. And so I looked at it as like this would be a cool thing to go try. I didn't think that, you know, in complete honesty, I didn't think I would be here 10 years later. But I got there and it was really cool to be at sort of a phase of an industry where it was more or less a completely clean slate across the board. You could whatever you wanted to wish up, you could try to make. And Nick was on a sabbatical from MIT that ended sort of shortly after they did the sort of Australia demo in mid-2014. And then the project sort of moved into its next phase with a new lead, Dave Voss, who was has been working in aerospace for a really long time. And that's when we sort of started going from, okay, this is a thing that will work on first principles, to how do we make something that like can be a business? How do we make something that serves a use case that, you know, has a big enough addressable market that it makes sense to go and invest in this? Dave ran the project for a couple years, and then I forget if it's 2016 or 2017, the years are all blending together for me at this point. Dave left, and the previous CEO, James Burgess, and I took over to sort of co-lead the project. We were still within X at the time. And we focused at that point really on like, how do we show enough of the sort of must believes on the business side to sort of make this have value as its own thing? So that's when we went back to Australia. We launched sort of the first service that was, you know, delivering packages sort of farther than you could see the airplane, and focusing on like, one, are there regulatory frameworks around the world that where this will work? Two, is the technology like ready enough that you could sort of make that leap? Three, is the technology at a sort of have a glide slope to a price point where it makes sense? And then lastly, and most importantly, people actually want it. We did that sort of, we spent most of 2017 sort of proving out all those pieces. And at that point, we sort of got to the phase where by that time, Alphabet had become Alphabet. And we sort of met all the criteria to be like, okay, this makes sense to spin out as a bet. And sort of you've earned your right to try to be a company. So that's the Cliff Notes version on sort of where we came from. And I like to think of it as like sort of like three eras of the program, sort of research, and then sort of like concept validation, and then build a business.
So one of the things that's really interesting about Wing to me is that it's one of these situations where you can sort of see a truth that's sort of true of all anything involving a vehicle, which is that the vehicle is just part of a broader system, yeah. Right? And I think sort of like what's really fascinating about Wing is this interplay of the vehicle and the infrastructure that you're building around it to make it work. And I want to get into that more, but first, you know, you're the vehicle designer, you're airplane designer. So I'm kind of curious, you know, what has that experience been like for you? I mean, you talk about the technology changing, but also clearly, you know, in the search for an actionable use case, you know, it's not just all about designing the right vehicle. It's also about designing the system around the vehicle. tell us just a little bit about the vehicle side of it so that we can sort of build from that into the.
I think that this has been one of my hardest sort of like personal professional developments over the last 10 years is like, how do I not be the airplane person? Like I love airplanes. Like, and even when I'm not doing airplane stuff for work, I like build airplanes, and like, it's just, it's been ingrained in me since I was a little kid. And you quickly realize as you go down sort of trying to build out a business in this space, the airplane is like the most interesting thing to look at, but it's in some cases like the least important part of the full system. And, you know, I think that that's a place where we made some sort of hard strategic and architectural decisions very early on in the program, to steer towards an outcome where like the airplane was just a cog in the broader machine. And for us, that really was, you know, one, making the decision that we weren't going to deliver everything, right? Like airplane design is very unforgiving. Like, there is no, like, everything is a trade. There's nothing comes for free. And if you really boil everything down, it's like everything relates to how much stuff you want to carry around. So everything scales by the weight of the box that you want to move. And for hovering stuff around the size of things that we work with, it's basically like, you know, if you take the weight of the thing you want to carry around, multiply that by four, and that'll be the sort of best you can do on the weight of the whole thing. And so you start rapidly approaching some practical limitations of both the technology and the regulatory frameworks. So particularly in the United States and for most regulators around the world, once you get above that sort of 50-pound mark for the whole vehicle, the rules vastly change. So you're operating much more like a Cessna or a Piper Cub than you are a drone. And so that puts a sort of practical limit on like how big the payload can be before you move out of this space of like a sort of tractable regulatory path into like, well, you might as well just build a 500-pound airplane at that point versus a 50-pound airplane. So for us, that was, we started looking at like, what is the use case and what is the sort of package size where we get the right intersection of a big enough market, like obviously if you're just like, hey, we can move around a single Tic Tac, like that's not super useful. But like, what's the size of stuff to carry on that people actually find use in it? And then make that sort of as small as possible so that the regulatory path is understandable. It's not going to be easy, but at least there's like rules of the road and like things that you can follow. And for us, that ended up being about 3 pounds of stuff. So about a kilo and a half. Now it's a little bit lower than that because like the only thing that ever goes up in over the course of the development of an airplane, like performance never goes up. It's always the weight goes up. The planes get heavier. So it was like about 2 to 3 pounds of stuff that ends up being about a meal for one or two people. It ends up being like most items in a convenience store. It ends up being like most items that you would run to a big box store to get, like, not to go do your whole week worth of shopping, but I don't have this HDMI cable that I need, or I need a bottle of cold medicine because everybody in the house is sick.
Which are really the most inefficient trips you make, right? I mean, when you go out for that one thing that's a tiny little thing and you're using, 4,000 pounds worth of steel and an internal combustion engine, I mean, talk about killing a fly with a sledgehammer, right?
Yeah, so that's where we settled on like that specific use case, not like a whole grocery cart, not sort of like delivering gravel with the airplane. And then sort of said, what is the smallest, lightest, cheapest airplane? We can wrap around that. That was a very multifunctional, multidisciplinary design exercise where like everything was pulling on everything else. It wasn't just like, okay, go design an airplane to go this far. It was like, go design an airplane that will go this far, be this reliable, cost this much, be able to fit into this side standard shipping pallet because you can't assemble it when it gets there. You know, be able to you know, fly in rain and wind and all the other things that you'd regularly drive your car in. And the end result is something that as a sort of airplane designer at heart, like I wouldn't have predicted what the airplane would look like by the time we finished it, because it's a balance between all of those different competing priorities.
What did you think it was going to be at the very beginning? Like how different if we were to put drawings next to each other?
One of the most straightforward examples is the sort of reliability case. So like, you know, how many different redundant components you need to be able to hit the target level of reliability you're looking for. That closes at 8 motors for the hover system. So with 8 motors, you can absorb a failure and like, you know, the meantime between failures all stack up so that you get the sort of target level of reliability you're looking for. It turns out that both the total weight of the installed propulsion system and the total cost of the propulsion system goes down substantially by going to 12 motors, which is like a very unintuitive trade. Like you wouldn't think like, oh, you have more parts, it's now cheaper. And that's for a bunch of things that sort of only become apparent when you look at the sort of whole system. And one of those is like, you can use smaller propellers. So they don't need to be made out of carbon fiber. They can be made out of, you know, glass reinforced plastic. Because you're using smaller propellers, you don't need to wind align them in cruise. Like you don't need to have them stop in any particular orientation because they're small enough that the drag of them in any orientation doesn't matter. And like the, you know, cost per sort of watt of motor actually goes down as the motors get smaller instead of going up, which is just like a combination of a supply chain and physics trade that like, so it's, you know, if I would have predicted like, yeah, we'll have an 8 rotor airplane with big fancy carbon fiber rotors that we wind align so that it's as low drag as possible in cruise. And it's like, yes, that wins on one of these performance axes, but it loses on these other 3 axes. And so you end up with, you know, more motors on the airplane. The other one that I, and this is one of the things that sort of we only learned by doing. You know, when we first built these airplanes, we were using like totally off the shelf components for the hover system. And it sounded like, you know, a cloud of the angriest mosquitoes or wasps or whatever. It was bad. It was objectively loud and like unpleasant. And so we invested a lot of time and energy in custom rotors for the hover system so that it was more pleasant sounding. It was lower decibel levels. You know, if you look at the props, there's like one blade is longer than the other. And those are so that they both make their own tone and the tones interfere with each other. And like, there's lots of science that went into the hover motors. And we did, at first, we did nothing on the cruise stuff. So basically, our plane is like if you sort of glued a helicopter or you glued a multi-rotor drone to an airplane. So it hovers with the hover motors. And then once it gets up to altitude, it turns on the cruise motors, gets up to speed. Once it's flying on the wing, it turns off the hover motors. And we just use like off-the-shelf stuff for the cruise propulsion. And because we're like, it's not that loud in cruise and it's like up high and like, who's going to care. But when it's hovering someone's backyard, they're definitely going to care about like, it sounding like a bunch of angry bees. We went and operated the system, even with like when we first started with the loud hover system. And like, I wouldn't say the plurality, but the vast, vast, vast majority of noise feedback we got was from overflight, not from hover. And I was like, this makes no sense to me. Like I've seen the plane fly around. It's like not, it's not that loud when it's flying overhead. But if you sort of think about the use case, when it's hovering in your backyard, you asked for the box, right? Like you called the service to you. If we're offering the service to you, like from what we've seen, it's usually like it permeates a neighborhood, like your neighbors use it and stuff. So they're like, oh yeah, like you're getting your delivery today. Cool. Like maybe mine's showing up in 10 minutes. But the 10,000 homes you flew over that didn't order the box, they're effectively like not participating in that delivery. And so that is like noise they didn't ask for versus the person getting the box that asked for it. So we quickly went through an exercise of like doing the same design work for the cruise propulsion. But it was one of those things where it's like, if you had asked me before we started flying, would anyone care about the noise of the plane flying overhead? Or would they care more about it hovering in their backyard or flying 300 feet overhead? I'd say absolutely they're going to care all about the backyard. And it was the complete opposite. So it's like, there's lots of examples of those sorts of sort of non-intuitive trades that have gone into the aircraft design, and then sort of interesting, unintuitive learnings that we've had as you start operating.
It's interesting to me because it's so many parallels to autonomous vehicle testing and deployment. like when you're ordering it, you're the one participating in this activity. And so there's a lot of forgiveness. But when, you know, what was it? Waymo had like the long line of robotaxis, like going down the same cul-de-sac and turning around, like no one was ordering those. The residents were just subjected to that. There was a lot of pushback, and that just like is a perfect analogy for introducing new technology, I think, to people. And so you, Wing and also AVs have this like really hard challenge, which is it's not just regulatory, it's not just the technology, it's not just the business model, but then on top of it all is like just consumer acceptance, not just from the user, but from everyone else who's kind of subjected to it.
Yeah. And it's even, I think that, you know, eVTOL broadly, sort of like, you know, everybody's wanted their Jetsons flying car since the Jetsons came out in the 60s or 70s. You know, drone delivery that, you know, the idea of it has been around for well over a decade now, and the sort of autonomous vehicle space broadly, like these are all things where the idea of it has existed for way longer than the sort of practical instantiation of it has existed. So I always say we're constantly at battle with the what ifs, like, because people have had decades to dream up what this is going to look like. There are consulting agencies within the industry that just talk about the what ifs. And you're sort of only just now at the point where you have the antidote to that, which is like the actual service. And so, you know, a lot of what we see when we go into new regions or new communities is like the first set of questions you get are all of those sort of what if scenarios that people have had a decade to think about. And then the second that you show them the service, they're like, oh, is that, that's what you're talking about? Like I frequently, whenever we bring our airplanes places, people will be like, is that a model of the airplane? Like, you're like, no, that's the plane. And they're like, well, I thought it would be much bigger. That's like a toy plane. We're like, yeah, no, that's what we've been talking about. That happened. I participated in a House T&I hearing last March as part of FAA reauthorization, and even there, we brought like the plane, and people were like, "Is that the plane, or is that like a mock-up model of the plane?" We're like, "No, like that's the this is what we've spent decades talking about." And so it's really interesting. You know, another one that I get all the time is when people hear the plane flying around, they're like, oh, I expected it to be much louder. And that's because like, the microphones in cell phone cameras happen to pick up the high frequency noise more than like if you had like a nice audio setup. So like every video recording that you hear of any drone flying around is usually more annoying than the actual sound of it flying around.
I'm wondering, you were talking about the Jetsons, and I'm wondering, like, some of the examples you have just given show that perhaps people's expectations, like, they're pleasantly surprised by fantasy versus reality. Like, oh, it's much smaller or quieter than I thought. But I'm wondering if you've encountered also, and if it's even a problem in terms of widespread adoption as this is rolled out and scaled up, of like the fantasy expectations just being so untenable that people are disappointed, like by what the reality is.
I think that we have sort of hypotheses around that, but the true answer sort of eludes us because you're not yet at the type of scale where you'd get that sort of real like organic pull or push. But I think that an example where sometimes sort of expectation and reality differ are like sort of simple aviation constraints that seem sort of unintuitive or complex to folks not in aviation. So for example, sometimes we have to be closed because the cloud ceiling is too low. And it's like, well, it's not raining and it's not windy and there's not a tornado. Like, why can't I get my package? And it's like, well, because the Federal Aviation regulations that we operate under say that like if the cloud cover is at this height, like we can't fly. I think, stuff like that around like where some of the have-tos of aviation sort of intersect with sort of like the expectations of a customer. I think that those are places where you're likely to get that disconnect or sort of that sort of misset of expectations. But broadly, we've seen sort of much more pull than push. It's usually like, okay, I think it's almost a certainty that everyone's first drone delivery order is because they want the novelty of it, like they want to take a video of it or they want to show somebody it. But they keep ordering, right? Like they, we see sort of relatively few like one and done type of customers. And I think that that's indicative of sort of the first principles utility of these types of services. I think once people actually use it, they see that it is, it makes sense. So, But I think that the jury is still going to be out on that, like until you really get like across a whole large city, and it's like, okay, after a year of serving a million people, do they have expectations that we're not meeting? Have they found some new use case that we didn't expect, and like we need to tailor the system to that? I think that so far so good.
And as we've seen with robotaxis and stuff too, some places just sort of have political, cultural environments that create different reactions from people, right, than others. And so there may be some of that as well. And again, until you're at scale, it's hard to know. But I'm curious, like you talked about the sort of an initial use case you explored as being, taking AEBs out to kind of remote areas where they didn't exist. And you mentioned the challenge with that specifically, but what's interesting, so there, right, like it's the same use case in that it's moving a small, object, right? So you have that limitation in place. But, there's a big difference between taking something far away to a remote place versus serving a kind of more dense area. And it seems like one of the things that is most different about that, at least in how you've rolled out, and is that the infrastructure, the bases for your vehicles and sort of how you create a almost like a networked, sort of system of locations as well as vehicles that kind of create the service is made up of these different parts. Talk about that transition from going, similar, small object, but longer distances in more remote places versus this, and how that kind of changes the vehicle design and things like that.
Yeah. It's, this is another one of those things that I think is fueled by the gap between idea and then implementation. And, you know, a big example of this is like, you know, one of the greatest fallacies in automation in robotics is that like people aren't involved, right? Like they're like, oh, I've built this robot and they'll like go do robot stuff. And it's like, oh, well, no, it's that robot plus a team of people servicing it and, you know, like moving spare parts around and picking it up. And like it's,
there's always a human in the loop.
There's always a human in the loop. And, we early on when we started to sort of go down the like, all right, we're gonna move food. We're gonna integrate with restaurants. We came up with all these Rube Goldberg machines. Like it was like, okay, you know, well, how do we swap the batteries out? Like, you know, because the plane, you don't want to wait for like, you know, the plane's gonna use up its whole battery and then come back and have to land. And then, you know, do we have a little robot arm that goes and like takes the battery and pulls it out and puts a new one in? How are you even going to get it in the right spot to do that? Like maybe there's another track that has to like move the thing into this right spot. How do you get the food into it? Like, oh, we need to cut a hole in the side of the restaurant and there'll be a conveyor belt that moves. I have like probably hundreds of slides of concept arts and like little mechanism diagrams about how you surround the robot with other robots. And at some point we were just like, no, like we've built this thing that can move around in 6 degrees of freedom, make it do all the stuff or make the concept of operations such that it doesn't have to do some of those other pieces or it can use existing infrastructure to do all those other pieces. So we made what I think is probably the most sort of foundational decision of Wing in sort of 2016, 2017-ish, which was like, the plane will do all the things it needs to do to operate. It's not going to have a bunch of specialized equipment supporting it. And that was hard because it meant like, okay, well, now we need to build charge infrastructures that isn't smart. Like it doesn't need precision orientation. It doesn't need somebody to connect something. We need the airplanes to be able to move themselves around if they're not quite in the right spot. We need them to be able to go to places they haven't been before and know what that, like sort of build a map quickly of sort of where they are. We need to be able to have the airplane grab the box, not somebody have to go and like put the box in the airplane. That's one of those things where it was like a bunch of hard engineering work to get to on the surface what looks like the simpler version of the system. And that piece is foundational to sort of how we architect all of our operations. So, you know, like where our airplanes live is like a sort of empty piece of flat surface. Like it could be on a roof, it could be in a parking lot, it could be in a dirt field. And we put down our charging pads, which are just like, they're a big circuit board. Like they're not like, there's no specialized connectors. You plug them into power. And then as long as the airplane is sitting on it, it'll get charged up and the airplane will talk to the back end, do all the things it needs to do. And so like, I've always looked at engineering problems like this, like, I really like Lego. So like building a Lego set, you can focus either on like, okay, should I build a rocket ship or a sailboat or a little robot? Or you can focus on like, what are the pieces I need to exist? And that's what we focused on, sort of invested a lot in the early phase of the program, is building those bricks. And we've assembled them into a rocket ship, but they could just as easily, sort of depending on the need of the particular use case, be reassembled into a sailboat or reassembled it, because like the core sort of building blocks are sort of all fungible and the same. And so that's where we are right now today, of like, we've got this big bin of bricks. We've assembled in this particular use case. And now it's like, what does the partner need? Like, does the partner need a sailboat? Does the partner need a rocket ship? And like, you know, the sort of two pertinent examples at the moment are like our two sort of The two big partners we're working with today are DoorDash and Walmart. Two very different businesses. And like two very different use cases in terms of how the goods, like where the goods come from. Like in the case of Walmart, like it's all in the store and they have associates that are working in the store sort of already packing orders for other things. How do you fit into that use case? With DoorDash, it's not one store. It's like every store in the region. How do you get the goods from each individual restaurant into the airplane? You can't have conveyor belts and little robots at each restaurant. Like that doesn't scale. And so, you know, a lot of it comes back to that network approach that you mentioned of like, we focused on building out those core capabilities, putting them into sort of nodes that could be reconfigured, and then trying to fit as closely into sort of the existing workflow that the partners have. So because we don't have this like overly specialized solution, we can sort of tweak it so that it fits into the Walmart parking lot. We can tweak it so that it sits on a roof of a mall and like everybody from the food court can go put packages on it. That's a long answer to your simple question.
No, it's great though, because that Lego box sort of, or Lego piece sort of answer that you give, like to me, it strikes me as like the difference between engineering a service that, which is like sort of necessarily a system versus engineering a product, right? Like so much of engineering, you know, design in particular, right? Like it's like, I'm designing a car. I'm designing this object. But when you're designing a service, you, as you say, you kind of have to build the pieces that allow you to adapt that and have it be a flexible thing that can be applied in varying use cases. So I think it's a really fascinating insight.
I'm wondering if you talked about how you've taken some humans out of the loop a little bit, automated, without building the conveyor belt. So the charging, for instance, like the drone can land and charge itself. But when I think about the two different partners you have, Walmart and DoorDash, there still obviously has to be a human in the loop somewhere. So can you, let's start with Walmart. How is that working out? Like, how does it work in terms of humans being involved on the ground? And is there a path forward in which you don't need to have a human in the loop? Meaning, I imagine right now you have like a Walmart associate or a wing person like grabbing the items and then putting it out. Yeah. So is there a way to automate that? And maybe you've achieved that already.
We've focused a lot on like, what do their existing workflows look like? So, you know, we're not going to deliver all the packages for any of these partners. So like, right now today, what does it look like for an associate to go do the pick pack in the store and then sort of like bring the box to the front? And right now today, the box is either going in a van, into somebody's truck, like a delivery van, into somebody's trunk that's sitting at the sort of curbside pickup spot. Or, you know, today it's being walked out and hooked on to the drone. Something that we've been working on for the last couple of years and is sort of starting to roll out is breaking that last link in the chain. So like right now today, the plane hovers, it lowers down the hook. Somebody has to go and put the box on the hook. And that's like a, you know, the plane can't hover there forever, right? Like it's like eating up battery like every second that's sitting there. And so it makes this untenable timing constraint for most of the partners of like the associate has to be outside at this particular minute within like a 10 second window. Like that's hard to integrate into a busy business. So instead it's like, how do you break that timing link? And what we've done is, I think we've shown you all these in the past, the autoloaders, which is like, it looks like a miniature field goal sort of setup. It's basically a resting spot for someone, one of the associates or sort of somebody working in one of the restaurants to go and put that box on that shelf in the same way that they, you know, put it on the rack that then the dashers come in and go grab the boxes, or they put it on the rack that the runner takes to go put into the trunk of somebody at curbside pickup. And then the plane at some other time comes along and picks up the box. So I think that, you know, you could probably think about some you know, other robotic solutions for getting the box from the front of the store to the autoloaders. But today there's sort of already a bunch of folks like doing those actions for the other forms of delivery. So like somebody is bringing that box out and putting it into a trunk.
So someday is there going to be like a humanoid bipedal robot that does that?
I'm not in the ground robotics sort of space, but you know, I think that's sort of on the partner side of how they're optimizing their sort of from the creation of the goods to the preparation of the box. That's sort of on the partner, and then sort of from the box readiness to us, that's where we do sort of the stuff that we're good at.
So I'm curious, you know, you partnered with Walmart, with DoorDash, you know, companies already have a lot going on in the delivery space. What for you guys, where's your value that you're providing? Is it purely a speed of delivery thing right now? Is there a cost efficiency advantage? Are some of these things, you know, more near term and some of them longer term? Sort of how does that look, especially as your relationship evolves and the technology improves?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of those two that you just mentioned. And I think that sort of in the near term, it's sort of about the sort of the speed and the use case itself and sort of showing like, hey, this is the value you as a consumer can get from essentially like just in time delivery of anything that you might jump in your car and run to the store for. In the long term, or I wouldn't even say in the long term, in the sort of medium term, like the sort of the cost argument is a good one, right? Like it's like, particularly for these small basket sizes or like a high value item that is light and sort of wouldn't make sense to throw in a van. Like it just like all of these folks understand the cost basis for like, I want to move this 20 ounce bottle of soda, in a car or in my delivery truck. And, if you boil it back to first principles, like it makes more sense to do it with something that's right sized for that application. So I think as you get to more meaningful scale, those cost benefits become very apparent very quickly. And it also sort of, it leads to more order frequency for smaller items, right? Where typically you'd be like, well, do I want to order this thing that like, you know, the delivery fee is similar to the price of the thing? Versus sort of once you have a service like this that starts to get more scaled out, like those sorts of small basket sizes and, you know, just in time ordering, like makes a lot more sense. So I think it's sort of today sort of speed and experience first to sort of show the value and then sort of follows on with the cost piece.
What is the consumer experience here, right? So you order something from Walmart or DoorDash like you would otherwise. If it's a small enough order that fits for one of your drones, you're in the service area, it pops up and says, hey, your delivery is coming by drone. Do you have to do anything? I assume now probably you have to have already opted in, but just walk us through sort of where maybe that user experience is right now, briefly. Yeah. And then again, like where you want to get it to.
Yeah, that's there's a couple different versions of it today, just sort of based on what stage we are at with different partners and what regions we're in. You know, for example, with DoorDash in Australia right now, like all the orders come in through their marketplace. So there's not like a Wing marketplace. They'll present an option of, hey, do you want this delivered by drone? Like it sort of meets the criteria to do it, or you know, do you not want that? Once you sort of go down the drone path, there's like one more step in the flow that's like, where do you want the box? Like it's mm-hmm. something that, you know, you wouldn't do during a normal delivery experience, but, you know, we'll pre-populate the area we're operating in with sort of like all the places where the airplane could drop off a box. And then sort of based on like the sort of parcel, like boundary associated with you, the person ordering, like we're on, presumably your property, do you want that box dropped off out of like a couple of different options for Walmart today? And sort of when we're operating first party, we have our own marketplace, that we sort of populate with the relevant SKUs from the folks we're delivering stuff for. But it's a similar order flow. It's like, you know, fill out your cart like you would with, any other sort of e-commerce platform. You'll get some, you may get a warning that's like, hey, like, this is actually too much stuff. Like, you know, you can't get the gallon of milk. And then sort of the last piece of, okay, where do you want it dropped off? And then, we're in the process right now of doing the same integration with Walmart of like, okay, now moving it into their marketplace and, you know, what the sort of order trees are there of sort of, you know, that decision-making point of, do you have it by drone or do you have it by any of their other delivery means? And it is, you know, there are some like, actually, this is back to your question of like, do you ever get sort of disappointment in the experience? You know, the plane needs a spot to go drop off the package. So, you know, we've had, you know, a handful of cases where, you know, you'll offer the service to a neighborhood. One neighbor will order the stuff. And then the neighbor across the street is like, why can't I order stuff? And it's like, well, you know, you either like, you know, you have too much tree coverage, like there is no spot that we can actually see the ground, or, you know, if neighbor A is right at the sort of edge of the range, like neighbor B might be slightly like, oh, it's like, there's just not enough watt hours in the airplane to get to your house. So that's one of the sort of, I think, it's unique in its presentation, but when you think to sort of like, you know, the experiences that people have today with on-demand delivery services, like sometimes you'll get a rejected order because it's like, hey, sorry, like you're just outside of my delivery area. I'm not going to go bring you that box. Or, you know, hey, nobody was home. We have to reschedule your delivery. So it's just like different types of like, you know, trying to explain to somebody like, hey, like, you know, it was windier today, or like the wind was coming from a different direction today. So your house, which is right on the border, the fuel gauge check failed for that planned flight because like it'll take slightly too many watt hours to get to your house, where yesterday it was green. So I think it's those sort of edge cases, and we're still working out like as you scale, how do you present that to people? Do you give people the option that's like, hey, your house is right at the boundary of what our service area is? You may be able to order some days, not be able to order some days. Do you want to order stuff? Or do you just say like, your house isn't in the service area? Sorry, like we can't guarantee 95% sort of service coverage. But those are like, that's the, it's really very similar to sort of any other sort of e-commerce interface. It's just, there's that last step of like, where do you want the box?
Right. And it makes sense, right, that you're integrated in the partner's marketplace, because then if you're not in the area, they just send it with a normal Dasher or whatever. Yeah.
So you've brought up scale a few times. And we know that you're working with DoorDash and Walmart, but give us a sense of where you're actually operating. And then are you growing? I think you're continuing to grow. And how are you doing that? Are you growing by just adding more geographic area to a single marketplace? Or are you going to brand new places that might have a small geographic footprint?
Yeah, I think that for where we stand today, you know, we have operations in Australia, in a number of different locations in Brisbane, with DoorDash. And then in the US, we have, most of our operations happen in the DFW area. And that's currently sort of two stores with Walmart, expand. And we sort of right at the beginning of the new year announced an expansion with them where we're going to be covering sort of, significantly more of the DFW area. So like, you know, going from tens of thousands of people that will be in the service area to like millions of people that are in the service area. So that's the sort of what most of the team is working on day to day is sort of that growth, you know, more stores, more service area, you know, bringing on more customers. And then we just announced that DoorDash will be coming to the US. And they'll start in, you know, the operational site that we have in Christiansburg, Virginia. which is the first place that we started doing our Part 135 operations. So that's the snapshot of what's happening sort of now and in the immediate future. And then sort of if you zoom back out to how we got to this step today, we've really focused on, from the regulatory side, like, how do you get to extensible approvals? So, like, for the last decade, it's like, okay, let's approve this GPS coordinate and this sort of surrounding, like, relatively small area. If you want to move that location, you know, 500 feet over there, new approval, like, new, start the process over. With DFW, as we sort of were looking to expand there, we focused on how do you approach those approvals from an area perspective? So how do you get, like, how do you say, okay, we are going to have a framework for all of DFW? And that's what we worked sort of most of the last couple of years on. And that was granted sort of late last year. So the path to more sites in DFW is well understood. And then that path, that framework can be applied to new places. So a lot of the sort of challenges with those things are like, how do you even articulate what you're trying to do? Like, how do you, like, which part of the FARs do you have to go and comply with? Which parts, like, do you need waivers for? All these other pieces. And so it's like, some of it is just figuring out, like, what test are we taking? Like, am I studying for a math test, or is it a gym class, or, like, or I have a biology exam tomorrow? And now we sort of know, we've firmed up, like, okay, this is the exam for sort of city expansion in the United States. And so, you know, the next logical step of that is, like, let's go do more.
How do you determine, so you're all over Dallas-Fort Worth now, or expanding to, you said, like, millions of homes. So how do you start to pick a city? Is it, I'm assuming there's a ton of factors, but maybe you could explain, like, how much weight they have, like, regulatory over environment, or, like, how do you pick a city?
It really starts from, there's a couple of sort of, like, very baseline requirements for us to begin with. So one, our detect and avoid approach, so, like, sort of how we monitor for traffic with people in it, is based on sort of cooperative airspace. So that's a long way of saying we listen for crude traffic. And so we need to operate in places where that crude traffic is required to broadcast. So we operate in what's called Mode C veils, which is an airspace classification where if you want to be in there, you need to have ADS-B on and broadcasting. So we, like, the sort of, you know, the what if of an errant sort of unequipped aircraft flying through, like, they're not allowed to be in that airspace. So that's how we approach the sort of deconfliction piece. That means that, like, we need to be in a Mode C veil. Fortunately, like, most major population centers in the United States are covered by a Mode C veil. So we sort of start there from an airspace suitability check of, like, is this a place where it both makes sense to fly and that we will, you know, there is a path to getting permission to fly. And then you sort of layer that on top of, like, okay, is the addressable population sort of enough? Is it, you know, does that addressable population sort of, like, are there merchants sort of distributed throughout it where, like, you can offer a meaningful service? Are there some, like, totally weird, like, terrain limitations or something like that? Like, is it on the top of the mountain? Like, that would be hard.
You have to have yards, right? I mean, yards kind of, I assume this is sort of a suburban thing in part because you have to.
Yeah, it's, I think that the, you need about a, like, a sort of 9-foot circle where you can see the sky. Okay. So it's not like, you don't need, like, a big sprawling yard, but you do need somewhere where you could look up and see clouds. But, you know, I think that that's one of those things that goes back to, like, we're not going to deliver everything. We're going to deliver stuff that makes the most sense for sort of our use case. And that's where that's where suburbs make the most sense. 'Cause it's, like, reasonably high population density. Traffic is still a problem, right? Like you still have to drive places to go get stuff. It's often like not a straight shot to get there, and there's traffic lights and things like that. And like the vast majority of the places where you would deliver, like meet that requirement of there's some spot on the property where you could look up and see sky. You know, I think that there's always technical paths to sort of, like that's the sort of big part of the bell curve. There's technical paths to sort of both tail ends of that. So like, okay, how do you deliver to high rise buildings and things like that? We tried some of that, like, in the operations we had in Finland a couple years ago, where it's like, okay, we'll have a common delivery zone for that apartment building. So like out in the courtyard, like everybody will get their boxes delivered to the courtyard. Or, you know, how do you deal with sort of, as you get out of the suburbs into sort of, more rural areas, like, you know, can you build a plane that needs to go that far? In those cases, you are often crossing out of the MOTSI veil into Class G airspace or sort of uncontrolled airspace. And so like the detect and avoid approaches need to change there because you're not guaranteed to have, equipped traffic, but that's where it's like, I want to build a business in the sort of bell, the heart of the bell curve first, and then you can start to sort of optimize on the ends.
Which gets back to the whole sort of Lego approach that you've taken here, which I think has been a really, really fascinating way to think about this whole thing. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I would have loved to have spent, in particular, we probably could have done a whole episode just on the regulatory piece of this, which is, like I know, super unique to flying and something I'm really always curious to learn more about. But we'll just have to have you come back and chat about it more in the future, because there's just so much to get into. Yeah, Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me. Really fun conversation.
And thank you for listening to another episode of the Autonicast.
All right.